Today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show, we're going to look at Roll20 and their integration with Discord. My friend Teo Sabadia over on the AlphaStream blog talked about looking at the D&D Summit 1 year later. Rob Schwab has been producing a new adventure path for Shadow of the Demon Lord called The Return of the Witch King. We're going to take a look at the first two adventures from that adventure path. Kobold Press now has a bundle on Shard that you can pay per month rather than buying the products outright. What does that mean, and should we buy it? Tales of the Valiant has a new mimic for us to look at. And we're going to take a deep look at using an Oracle die to help you run your games. And we're going to cover more questions from the April 2024 Patreon Q&A all today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in tabletop role-playing games. This show is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to the Sly Flourish Discord server, where you can connect with other lazy DMs and share tips and tricks and talk about industry news and all of these things all throughout the week. Patrons also get access to the monthly Q&A to get questions and answers for all of their tabletop role-playing game questions. They get access to a bunch of exclusive adventures. They get access to an early version of the City of Arches sourcebook, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, and a whole lot more. It's a fantastic deal to be a patron of Sly Flourish. And to the patrons of Sly Flourish, thank you so much for your outstanding support. So one piece of big news that happened this past week is Roll20 announced that they are coming directly to your Discord server. Soon you'll be able to play your favorite TTRPGs right in Discord. My cynical nature, I had two cynical takes on this. I guess we'll get to the cynical takes in a bit. It's pretty neat. Lots of people use Discord. I use Discord to run RPGs. It's a fantastic way to connect with people through video and audio. It's very, very stable. It has like both like instant chat and persistent chat. Discord is a fantastic tool for running your tabletop role-playing game. And Roll20 is by far the largest virtual tabletop available for role-playing games overall, but certainly for D&D. And now you can apparently launch and run Roll20 directly in Discord as one of the activities in Discord. One of my cynical takes is, I think, is that just a browser window? Like, I think it's like a launcher and then opens up to a browser window. I wonder really like how much actual integration will take place. For example, can you take the channel that handles all of your dice rolling and other clicks and stuff, is that still going to be inside the window for Roll20, or is that going to pass it through to Discord? I have a feeling it's essentially, I would expect, it's essentially a browser window that executes inside Discord. Now, this could be very easy for players who don't really fully understand Roll20. It's probably an easier way for them to launch Roll20 and get into a game. So that could definitely be cool. So I don't know what the level of actual integration is, and we'll have to see. Obviously, there's a lot of people that are very excited about the partnership. We also don't know what the partnership exactly is, but it could be a very big deal. So I'm not sure if it's a very big deal or if it's basically like, hey, we have another way for you to launch a browser window. It's going to be pretty interesting. My other cynical take, and I recognize like this is just Mr. Grump. I have another thought about how I'm Mr. Grump and why I'm Mr. Grump in particular areas. But it is one proprietary platform being launched inside of another proprietary platform, both of which are now brittle. In other words, like Discord could go whatever direction they're going to go. Roll20 could go whatever direction they're going to go. And if you are dependent upon both of these platforms, you have to go along with both of them. And there's a level of rigidity. There's a level of fragility with online services, whatever they are, because you're kind of at the whims of whatever that online service wants to do. It's not distributed. It's not local. You can't decide like, you know what? I like the old version. Foundry is probably the only VTT where you can really say like, I like the old version. Albert Rodeo, you can run the old version. It's kind of clunky to run the old version. And most people kind of move along. But any of the server-based services, whatever direction they go with it, you're kind of stuck with. Now, on the other hand, you don't have to install any software. You don't have to buy expensive packages. You're not at, you know, you don't have like weird open source bugs that can come up from time to time. So there's a lot of different things. And a lot of people use Roll20 and they're very happy with it anyway. But there is a bit of like, you know, are we all of the stuff where I talk about, hey, when you buy books on D&D Beyond, you're stuck with D&D Beyond and you're stuck with whatever they're going to do. The same is true with any of these platforms. I'm picking on D&D Beyond, but the reality is any of these online services, you're kind of stuck with the same thing. If you buy a module in Roll20, you're stuck with Roll20. Lots of people are. So it does bring, you know, if the more dependent you are on any given platform or even two interconnected platforms, the more you have to kind of worry about that. Or you just don't worry about it. Right? You don't have to listen to me and you cannot worry about it. And if you're already using Roll20 all the time, it looks really good. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, what the actual level of integration is. Is it really just a launcher that then launches up Roll20 in a browser window, which is kind of what I think it is. I don't think it's a lot of deep integration with Discord, but I could be wrong. So we'll see. Anyway, that was a very interesting thing that has come up. The idea that Roll20 and Discord, which are probably two I would imagine they're two of the most popular, if not the two most popular platforms for running online RPGs, is probably Roll20 and Discord, and that those two are now connected. So that's pretty interesting to see. My friend Teo Sapadilla wrote an excellent article. He was at the in-person summit that Wizards of the Coast ran early last year in their drive to reestablish a relationship with the community after the whole OGL fiasco. And they made kind of a bunch of promises about things that they wanted to do. There was lots of discussions. I've talked all about the summit. I don't think we need to bring back 18 months worth of talk about the summit. But Teos wrote an article that kind of says, hey, where are we? Like, where are we with all of these things? What happened? And an example is like, I think it was the only summit, right? Like, there was rumors that they were going to do a summit at Gen Con, and then they kind of didn't. I, you know, did get a note that said, hey, we'd love to meet with you at a time, but I wasn't going to Gen Con. So I said, no. And I was like, is that a summit? And they're like, oh, no. And then I asked, like, did anything come from that? And they're like, ah. So it's pretty interesting. And they go back and forth of like, is it actually helping? I bet on the inside of Wizards, they're like, is it really helping that we have these? Because we got a lot of people that are mad at us about the summit too, including me. And so the big question is like, are they doing it anymore? And then they talk about WotC's accomplishments. And so, if you're interested in like looking at the summit and what happened, I would definitely recommend reading Teos's article. I read it. I think it's great. I think he brings up a lot of really good points. Teos comes from a couple different perspectives. One is how Wizards can improve themselves, how they can be a better company that's doing things, and also how Wizards can continue to improve the hobby. I focus on the latter part. I kind of don't care what Wizards of the Coast does themselves. I care about our impact for us as GMs. I bring up a lot of times about the great things that Wizards of the Coast has done over the past year. Putting out, obviously, the SRD in Creative Commons is huge. Putting it out in four different languages in the Creative Commons is huge. And supporting other virtual tabletops other than their own, like Foundry for the first time. Foundry, Roll20, I assume Fantasy Grounds, and we'll see about other platforms as well. Their school program is excellent, right? They have a lot of free resources for teachers and for after-school clubs. So there's a lot of things that they are doing that I think are actually directly helping the overall hobby. And I personally don't think there's a lot that they've done in the last year and a half since the OGL that really has hurt the hobby. I can't really put my finger on anything. So I think they've done a lot. But one thing that has been on my list, and I'm like, hey, where is this, is they said that they were going to put out the 3.5 SRD in the Creative Commons, and they have not. Now, you could argue, do you really need to? Because you can kind of reverse engineer a lot of 3.5 stuff with the 5e SRD. So if you really care to, you wouldn't need to. And now also, like, Pathfinder has the whole Pathfinder SRD that's available under the Orc license and other things, and that's basically 3.5 license. So do you really need it is one question. But they did say they were going to do it. So if you say you're going to do it, you should do it. If you want to show that you are, you know, being direct and honest about the promises you make, do it. Right? Like, just do it. And it's already out. Like, it's out under the OGL already. So why not just do it? So I wish they would do that. And then the other one that I would really like is I would like clarity about what they are going to do to support the Creative Commons SRD with the 2024 material. I know it's not even out yet, and it could be a year or two away before they decide to do it. But I would like them to further make a commitment to what they are actually going to release into the Creative Commons from the 2024 material, not, because I feel like the words they've used on that are really waffly, and they're like, oh, it's compatible, so we don't need to do anything, is like the answer. And that's not really a great answer. A lot of people are going to say like, oh man, that means we can't use anything in 2024, and it's going to stint a lot of developers. So I think that would be a problem. I would like to see them do that. Teos has a fantastic list of lots and lots of other things too. If you want to take a look at it, please take a look at it. This is definitely an article if you're into kind of the D&D business, the Wizards of the Coast business, and want to learn more. I think it's a really good even-handed look at the summit, what Wizards has done since, and the things that they can continue to do to continue to be good members of the community. Really good. Talking about another role-playing game, Shadow of the Demon Lord by Robert Schwab. Robert Schwab was on a podcast and a video called Nostros and Dragons, the La Taberna de Rol. I'm sorry, I don't speak Spanish, and my pronunciation has got to be terrible. La Taberna de Rol. Why do I say it twice if I suck at it the first time? Anyway, he did a really good interview on this, and one of the things he talked about was the way that he wants to continue to support the RPGs that he's put out. He says he doesn't really like it when a lot of times an RPG will come out, and then nothing else ever comes out for it again. And he's been proving this with Shadow of the Demon Lord. While he's been working on Shadow of the Weird Wizard, Demon Lord is like 8 years old now, and he is still putting out new material for it. And the latest thing he has put out is the beginning of a new adventure path for Shadow of the Demon Lord called the Return of the Witch King. So the Witch King is like this weird villain that is in the background of the Shadow of the Demon Lord primary world. And he wrote a lot of stuff about it in the lore. The lore for Shadow of the Demon Lord is fantastic. And Robert Schwab has tons and tons of these little supplements that kind of bring about all these little bits of lore of the world of Shadow the Demon Lord. It's a really, really rich and cool world, and I like it a lot. And so seeing that there's now an adventure path coming out for it is excellent. You can pick up the adventure path on DriveThruRPG. That's the second one. First of these is called Falling Tears. You can find links to both of these on DriveThruRPG in the show notes. Falling Tears is a starting adventure, so you're basically a zero-level character, and the whole thing is that you're trying to escape from armies of orcs that are overtaking the area, and you are being hunted. Your village has been burned. You're running away through the woods and being attacked by orcs, and then in some circumstances running into other groups. What's interesting is as a starting adventure, it is not a very typical adventure. It is an adventure. It is a survival adventure where you have this gridded map and you are trying to make it from one place to another. You start in area C8, I think it is. So you start here in the woods, and your goal is to like make your way through here and escape and not get killed by spiders and not get picked up by orcs and everything else. And you sort of, you know, it's very much like a exploration adventure, where you are rolling to determine like what you want to do in a given square, whether or not you want to move, risks of getting lost, risks of making too much noise and getting attacked. So there's like a bit of a survival horror stealth kind of game going on in here, which I think is an interesting take. I don't know that I'm 100% on board with it, because it looks like, hey, I've got to learn a new subsystem for how to kind of run through it, but it looks kind of neat. And if you're interested in this sort of almost like a board game of how your group can escape the clutches of the armies of King Drudge, and it's all about you trying to get out of this area that's being overtaken as part of this. So that's the first one that takes you, that's level zero and takes you to level one. Here's some interesting little background things you can pick up on. And then the second one is now at first level. You're a novice tier adventure, and you are making your way through a kind of a valley, or like a series, I think it's a valley or like a series of caves, or like a pass, and or people are making their way through the valley, and they're reporting that there's these weird white ghosts that are attacking them. It turns out that they are this really terrible tribe of troglodytes that are able to kind of crawl out of the cracks in the walls and grab people along the way and conduct horrible ceremonies and situations. And it turns out that they are in fact committing these vile rituals in favor of the return of the Witch King. So this is directly from the movie Bone Tomahawk. I know Rob Schwab loves the movie Bone Tomahawk. I love the movie Bone Tomahawk. It is a really, really gruesome horror movie set in the Old West. And if you dig that kind of movie, you'll dig this kind of adventure. Both of these adventures, they don't have it, and I kind of wish they would. Definitely need some, you know, trigger warning kind of stuff. These are incredibly gruesome, incredibly grim adventures with some really dark material in there that you should probably expect from a Shadow of the Demon Lord adventure. So I don't think you're probably going to buy this and not recognize how, I mean, just look at that art, for example. It's pretty gruesome. There is some really sick, twisted stuff in these adventures. If you are into really dark, sick, twisted adventures, well, these will be right up your alley. If you're more interested in high fantasy, you know, even keel, PG-13-ish, maybe touch of R once in a while, then these are not adventures for you. But I'm interested. I love his writing. I love the worlds that he develops here. And I am eager to see the full continuation of this series of adventures from, I guess there'll be 11 of these, from 0 to 10, that take you all the way through to the Return of the Witch King. I am glad to see that he is doing them. They are like $2 each. They're really cheap, and about 7 pages long. They also show you, I think they're really good examples of how small adventures can be that give you just enough material to, see there's some grim pictures, that, you know, just enough material to be able to run an adventure. So Pixel Chew says, not for the kids. I don't know. When I was a kid, I loved stuff like this. So I don't know. I would probably say not below the age of 13, and your 13-year-old better be relatively mature to handle that out. So yeah, really interesting stuff. So that's Shadow of the Demon Lord, The Return of the Witch King Adventures. There's two of them. The first one is called Falling Tears, and the second one is called You Shall Not Take These Noble Souls. Although a lot of noble souls get taken, so that's not exactly an accurate thing. A new interesting sort of way to buy rent material has showed up on Shard Tabletop. has Shard as another virtual tabletop. It's a really good one. It's one thing I really like about Shard is that the character builder can kind of be run separately from the rest of the VTT, which you can use it just as a character builder. It's one of the few that you can do it. Like Demiplane is one. D&D Beyond is obviously another for 5th edition anyway. And Shard is another one that lets you kind of load a mobile-friendly version of your character sheet on a phone. Kobold Press now has a subscription service, a Game Master subscription service. And in this subscription service, you get access to 26 different books for $7 a month or $75.50 a year. So it's an interesting new way. A lot of people have said, like, hey, is D&D Beyond ever going to offer a subscription service where instead of buying books individually on D&D Beyond, you can instead say, just give me the GM package and I'll pay so much a month and I'll have access to all of them. The one thing I like about this, I've been thinking about, like, well, when would this be a good deal and when wouldn't be? I'm going to say my general recommendation is you're still better off buying the PDFs. Just go buy the books. And in particular, especially for Kobold Press, but other publishers too, when you find the opportunity to pick up their material on a bundle of holding or on a Humble Bundle, that is the best deal you're going to get. Because I'm pretty sure Kobold Press has had bundles of holding before that are under $75 that contain almost all of these books in them and as PDFs that you then own. Now, they're not integrated with Shard at that point. You don't have like the library, you can look it up inside Shard. You don't have the character options built into the character builder. You don't have a lot of that sort of thing. So that can be a consideration on why you'd want to get it here. You can, of course, purchase them on Shard as well as renting them on Shard. But with every one of these centralized services, even when you purchase it, are you really purchasing it? Because you don't get to download it. You know that if the site goes away, all of your stuff goes away with it. So I still feel like getting the PDFs directly from the publisher is the sort of the best of both worlds. They get the most money because you're buying it directly from their store. They don't have to give a kickback to anybody else. And you get a product that you can save on your hard drive, put on a USB disk, and stick in a safe deposit box. So that is a value there too. So when would I recommend something? I mean, you're going to do what you're going to do. And if you look at this and you say, you know what, if I'm only running a limited campaign in Kobold Press, but I want to have access to a lot of these books, I don't want to have to buy all these books separate, but I also don't need to crud up my hard drive with a whole bunch of stuff I'm not going to use later, then maybe this is okay for you. One thing I like about it is it makes it very clear to you that you don't own the books, right? There's no expectation that if you're paying $7 a month to get access to this, that you're going to always have those books. That eventually, you know, either you're going to stop paying for them or they're going to stop serving them and you're not going to have access to those books anymore. It's sort of in the same way that if you have an online music streaming service, if you're using Apple Music or Amazon Music or something like that, you don't have an expectation you get to keep all your albums when you stop subscribing. You know you don't own those albums. You know you're subscribing to a service. You know you can stop and you won't have access anymore. You know you can start with somebody else and suddenly you'll have access again. So you know that that's the case. It's a little different when you're buying a book on an online service. You get the impression that you own it when you really don't. So that's a difference. But to me, if you can't put it on a hard drive, disconnect your machine and still open it, you don't really own it, right? So that I think is, at least with this one, you understand exactly what you're getting. So, you know, a lot of it is like, if you were going to run an Empire of the Ghouls campaign and you say, like, what books do I need for Empire of the Ghouls? My wife and I were talking about this on our walk today. It's like 7 books. So if you were going to buy all 7 of those books directly from the site in PDF, you know, they're going to cost you $20 to $30 a piece. So let's do a little bit of math. So, you know, it's like $175, $200 for you to be able to buy all of those books. Now, you know, okay, $75 a year, $100. If your campaign is going on for 2 years, you're probably still better off buying the books. Now, if you want all of these books, you want everything that's in here, that's going to cost a lot. Now, again, I would still say probably you're going to see a time when you can pick up the books on sale, when they have bundles of their own that they sell, bundles of holding, Humble Bundles, and things like that. And those are by far the most efficient way for you to pick up a lot of books is through bundles of holding and Humble Bundles and things like that. And any other kind of bundle that sometimes the sites run themselves, you can often get really good deals on those. So that's what I would recommend. I think this is interesting because it is another model for us to be able to purchase material to run for our TTRPGs. On the brittleness scale, how brittle does this make it? How fragile is our hobby? This is pretty fragile, right? You're dependent upon this one site. You can't take your data and move it to another site. You can't download it and make sure that you have it for forever. It is like a lease. Yeah, it's exactly like a car lease, right? You're paying money every month, but it's not a car you actually own. So I think that that's a consideration. This does bring up like a topic. I was talking with a couple of friends of mine over on the Sly Flourish Discord server about kind of like, you know, how I talk about Wizards of the Coast and how I talk about this other thing, and that I come across as being anti-WotC, right? When I'm like, no, I actually love lots of products that are coming up for D&D. I worry about like D&D Beyond becoming gravity well. And the real thing is that like one thing you get from me that you probably don't get from a lot of other people that you talk to is I do have this focus on sort of digital interoperability, that this is something that I think a lot about. I read about it a lot. It's something that I've kept a lot in my mind over many years of like, when do you really own digital data? And it's changed so much, and we've become so used to centralized services. I was reading a really good article that talked about how like people under a certain age don't recognize the internet as being a series of different social media platforms. Like the internet to them is, I think it was Penny Arcade talked about this, right? Penny Arcade had a really good article, and they talked about the idea that like a lot of people don't recognize the internet is anything other than Facebook or YouTube or TikTok and things like this, that they are all centralized platforms. Everything is a centralized platform, is a way that people look at it. And anything else, they're like, I don't even understand how that works. And I saw it when Mastodon came out, and people on Mastodon, a lot of people are like, I don't understand Mastodon. How am I supposed to know what server to belong to? And it's like, well, that's the joy. You get to belong to different servers, and you can move from one server to another. And you know that all of your followers will follow you from one server to another, and assume that server administrator makes sure that that works. So, and some people are like, I just want a centralized server. And you're like, well, that's why we had all the problems we have with centralized services. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And it means that when people hear the kind of stuff that I say, it sounds like I'm bashing groups that are centralizing their services. When what I'm really saying is like, you got to remember, these services do go down. Companies take these down. Companies go out of business. Companies sell stuff. New people buy them. They change their minds. And we definitely have a history where companies have taken people who bought their digital stuff and then removed their ability to get it because they were centralized services and somehow the business model changed. That definitely happens. How do we prevent that? Make sure you can download your stuff. Get it on a way that you can download it to your hard drive, that you can put on a USB disk, that you can run it offline. Then you kind of know even that's not 100%. Real 100% is buy the physical book. You get a physical book, nobody can take it from you. And I think, you know, lots of us would agree. You want a resilient piece of TTRPG, buy a physical book. That's the best thing you can do. Those can last 100 years. With, you know, well cared for, books can last a long, long time. And you don't have to worry about like formats changing or USB disks losing their power or anything like that. But that's one thing that you will get from me on this show when I'm talking about stuff like this, is that the idea of digital interoperability, digital archiving, those sorts of things are just important to me. Right. And so you're going to hear about it. And that's why I think this is interesting. It's interesting to me. I don't think this is like a bad thing. All right. I'm not saying, oh, this is evil. It's just another way to get it. And you can do it or not. And I don't think that this misrepresents the idea that, hey, if you were to pay for this per month and you stop paying, you're not going to get it anymore. Right. I think that is pretty clear to people when they do something like this, which I don't think is quite as clear when you buy a product online for an online only service. And then that online only service gets shut down, which has happened for lots of different services. That was interesting. Kobo Press also recently put out the Mimic, a sample of the Tales of the Valiant Monster Vault preview for the Mimic. It's got lots of interesting things going on for the Mimic, but boy, one thing really stood out to me, and that's that this thing does insane amounts of damage, and enough damage that I'm worried about it, and I'm worried about the Monster Vault. We'll have to see when it comes out. I'm you know, it's coming out. I don't know when the Monster Vault exactly is coming out, but I'm worried that the challenge rating for Kobold Press for Tales of the Valiant is going to mean something different than the challenge rating does for the rest of 5e. And I'm worried about that from a compatibility standpoint, because normally I wouldn't be like, oh, it's 5 damage more. I'm not too worried about it. This guy's like, you know, 2.5 times more damage, right? It's really, really high. Armor class 12 AC, 58 hit points, all the typical stuff that you have for a Mimic. Mimic makes 2 pseudopod attacks. If grappling a creature, it can replace one attack with a bite attack. So it can do a pseudopod and a bite attack after it has grappled somebody. If grappling a creature, so it could do it on the first round. The pseudopod attack is +5 to hit. Very reasonable to hit. 10 damage, that's pretty high. And then it's grappled. Now, subject to the adhesive trait, adheres to anything, a huge or small creature is grappled by it. So it's not restraining. So that's at least one good thing. You are grappled, but not restrained. Because if you were restrained, it would be really tough. The bite attack does 7 piercing damage plus 7 acid damage. That's 14 damage just for the bite. So that means between the bite and the pseudopod attack, you're doing 24 points of damage on the average at challenge rating 2. Now, to give you an idea, we look at Forge of Foes as my benchmark. Myself and Scott Gray and Teo Sabadia spent a lot of time balancing out what we thought the appropriate amount of damage was for creatures at different level, and it's 17. So 17 to 24 is a 7-point damage difference. You know, that's significant. You know, that's a 40% above what I consider to be the benchmark for CR2. I wouldn't mind that so much, except challenge rating 2 is pretty low. So that means you're facing lower level characters, and lower level characters are definitely squishier than higher levels. If this was happening at like CR10 and above, I'd be a little less worried, because characters have so many ways to mitigate damage at high levels. If you really have guys that are doing above, that's a lot. So not only does it do all that, but it also has a reaction Prey Shield. And these abilities are really cool, right? I like them. I just think they do too much damage. Prey Shield. When a creature the Mimic can see hits it with an attack, while it is grappling a creature, the Mimic can roll the grappled creature in front of the blow, forcing the grappled creature to take the damage instead. Hits it with an attack. So it's automatic. If it gets hit, it gets to do this. And now you're doing character damage, which somebody brought up the fact that character damage is often significantly higher than monster damage is. Because you could do that in like a rogue sneak attack, right? And a rogue sneak attack could do a whole bunch. You can assume that that's going to be on the average of 5 to 10 damage more. So now you have 24 points of damage from its actions, plus like another 5 to 10, to 29 to 30. So now it's doing like around 30 damage at CR2. I'm all about high damage monsters. I would say that the Forge of Foes stats actually hit a little hard because we wanted them to hit a little hard. But oh man, this one looks like it hits too hard. And it does make me worried about the monsters, particularly low challenge monsters that we're going to see in Kobold Press. Now, it could just be an easy matter of saying, treat them as though they're 1 CR higher. And that, I bet you that would probably work pretty well. 30 damage is still a lot of damage for a CR3 monster. But the problem is, I don't think that these are going to be pretty straightforward pull out and drop in monsters that you can just replace any 5th edition monster with. Because from what I'm seeing from a couple of these, they had the white previously. The white I actually thought was pretty good. So we're going to have to take a look more when the Monster Vault fully comes out and dig into it. But I worry that if we're seeing, I mean, this is a significant amount of damage. It's almost, you know, when you throw that reaction in there, it's almost twice as much as I would think it ought to be at that CR. And again, I worry less about that at high CRs. High CRs are where monster damage is really out of whack. Low damage for monsters wasn't really that bad. It was very swingy, though. If you look at the 2014 monster manual, again, giant seahorses were crazy. So anyway, we'll see. Right, we're going to see when that comes out what that looks like. But I thought that was, you know, caught my attention. To give you an idea of like how we balance monster damage and everything like that, I want to show you a tool. So myself and Teo Sabadia and Scott Fitzgerald Gray wrote a book called Forge of Foes. Forge of Foes is a book for you to be able to build and improvise and run really awesome monsters for your 5th edition game. It's got tons and tons of articles for advice. It's got cool monster powers you can attach to monsters, ways to modify existing monsters, how to run boss battles, everything that we could think of when it came to how to run monsters in 5th edition, we threw into Forge of Foes. We are extremely proud of this book. It is available in the Sly Flourish bookstore, and you can pick it up in the show notes. One of the things that I developed for patrons of Sly Flourish is a very quick, mobile-friendly... One of the things I built for patrons of Sly Flourish is a Forge of Foes 5e monster stats tool. This tool, it's mobile friendly. You can use it on a desktop. You can use it on mobile. Very, very simple tool that lets you pick a challenge rating of any type, and it gives you the Forge of Foes stats for that particular monster as both a stat block and as a one-line stat block. You can copy this and you can throw it right into your Notion notebook or your Obsidian notebook. Because it's an HTML, it will format nicely in those notebooks. And we also have this one-line stat block where if you want to have have like one that you just put in reference in your notes, you can grab this one little one line note and drop it in your notes and off you go. The page itself also has a bunch of different monster features. These came from the Lazy DM's companion that you can take and you can drop onto your given monsters. Many of them are standard sort of fifth edition ways. So if you want common ways to modify your monster, you can do this. And then I have a list of particular conditions that they might apply and the rules for those conditions. So you have a nice single tool. It also includes conditions from level up advanced 5e, like fatigue and strife, which you can drop in there. So if you want to change things a little bit, you can have creatures that inflict strife upon them. And all of this is available in this one nice single, very easy to use, a mobile tool. It's got big text because I'm old and it's harder for me to see things these days. So when you bring it up on a phone, it's very easy to read on a phone. And this feature, this Forge of Foes 5e Monster Stats, is just one of a whole bunch of different little digital tools that I've written up to help GMs run their games as part of becoming a member of the Sly Flourish Patreon. So if you want to help support this show, you want cool tools like this, please become a patron of Sly Flourish. You can find a link for becoming a patron in the show notes. Very reasonably priced. And it's a single HTML page. You can save this to your local desktop and run it. And that way you don't have to assume that I am always going to have it. It is a self-hostable file. You right click, save as, save the HTML. And that HTML page is a single contained HTML page that has all of this information in it. So you can use that. And that way it's a downloadable, a true downloadable resilient tool. As Robert Tables, good old Robert Tables says, it is a resilient tool because you can download it. Tomorrow, I will have download links on these so that you just have one click with a zip file that downloads the single. And you can do it anyway. You could just save as HTML and you're good. But you can also click like download and it will download a zip file. You unpack that zip file and inside there is the HTML page that's completely self-contained. So last week in my Shadow Dark game, I had a character who was in a life and death situation. They had been knocked unconscious and an evil doer had held his broadsword to her throat while she was unconscious and demanded that the other characters like drop their weapons and let him go, essentially. And they were pretty confident that even if he managed to try to escape, he was going to try to kill her anyway. He was a really bad guy. And I was stuck in the situation where I want the character to survive. The character's really, really cool, pretty integral to the story of the game. It would be bad if they died. And the players said, we're going to go after him because we think he's going to try to kill her anyway. And so I said, okay, let's roll a die. And on a 1 to 10, you are not able to get up to him in time. And on 11 to 20, you are. And to share the story, I had the player whose character was at risk roll the die, and she rolled a 20. And that completely changed the whole outcome. In fact, I said, with a 20... she turns out she wasn't unconscious and she got to attack the guy and she didn't attack him, but she opened up a portal to another world behind him and a big crystalline sentient monster grabbed him and squeezed him like a juicer and he was dead and everybody lost their minds. It was really, really cool. That is one example of using this concept called an oracle die. An oracle die is essentially a 50-year-old idea and it's, hey, if there's an element in the game that has some kind of probability to it, and you want to determine what actually happens, instead of you coming up with an answer yourself as a GM, you roll a die to see what happens. Many, many GMs figure this out on their own. You don't need me to tell you how to do this, but it's such a valuable tool that I think it's something worth talking about and discussing and like figuring out where we can do it. A very lightweight way of using an oracle die is determining which character a monster might attack. If there are four characters and there's a monster and it's not super clear which character the monster would attack, you roll a d4 and, you know, assign those numbers to individual characters, roll a d4, and whoever comes up, that's the one that gets attacked. That is an example of using an oracle die. But you can use oracle dies for all kinds of different things. And I wrote an article on Sly Flourish that I'm going to publish, but I wanted to talk about it here on the show too, because I think it's really valuable. And it's essentially like you can do all kinds of things with your oracle die. And really easy way is to basically say, start with something being a 50-50 shot. If you have a probability of something that's going to happen in the game and you're wondering, is this going to happen or not? Make it a 50-50 shot. On a 1 to 10, one thing happens. On an 11 to 20, something else happens. Or on odds, something happens. On even, something else happens. Or roll a d6. A lot of people say, grab any die. You'll see this in various books. If you ever want to figure this out, grab any die and roll it. And on an even, one thing happens. On an odd, something else happens. That way you don't even have to care what die you're rolling, like, because there's no d5 and d7. They're all even distribution dice for the most part. I think. There's probably some weird dice out there. It's like a D7. Essentially, you could just roll a die, and on an odd, one thing happens, on an even, something else happens. Or again, if you roll a D20, on a 1 to 10, one thing happens, on an 11 to 20, something else happens. But the nice thing about using a D20, you can use a 20-sided die for this. And the nice thing about a 20, this is my great big metal D20. I think I got this from Easy Roller Dice. Yeah, Easy Roller Dice sent me this die, and it's really cool. Check out Easy Roller Dice. And the nice thing about a D20 is that it has a lot of like fluidity to it. That 1 to 20 has little 5% increments all the way from the bottom to the top. So instead of just saying like on an odd, one thing happens, on an even, something else happens, you could say like, I want to roll in the attitude of somebody. And on the lower the roll, the worse the attitude. And the higher the roll, the better the attitude. And then use it as almost like an analog gauge. Right, you have all these sort of 5% increments. You don't have to decide what each one of them is. You could just say, okay, you go up to the town guard, how grumpy is he? And I roll a 7. So it's like, he's a little tired, right? He's not like super grump, right? But he's like, I'm a little tired, I've kind of dealt with people like this before. So it's like, what do you want today, right? But then, you know, you go to the bar, and how's the bar, the person at the bar is a 13. No, they're pretty optimistic, right? They're okay. A 20 would be really optimistic. A 1 would be really not, like, I hate you already, I'm gonna stab you in the eye with a butter knife. But like, you have a wide range, but you can use this for all different kinds of things. And so some examples that I wrote up in the article is like how alert the guards are. Are the guards really alert, or are they kind of asleep? What's the attitude of those guards? If you're, you know, an obvious one is a morale check, right? Are the people going to run away, or are they going to stay and fight? Like, you beat down half of them, roll a die, the lower the roll, the more likely they are to stay, the higher the roll they are to run away, or vice versa. You get to decide. Are characters acting smartly or more chaotically in battle? That was an example where before he held the broadsword to her throat, I rolled to determine whether or not he was so wild he was just going to try to kill her and run. And instead, and if I roll high, he keeps his wits about him and tries to use her as ransom. So, you know, that's an example where you can determine what that die is. Obviously, determining which character a monster might attack, that's a really easy one. Determining if a servant is in a room or not, right? So if you have a heist where the characters are kind of going from room to room, you might say, well, it's not necessarily a monstrous encounter, but I'm going to roll that the servants are going around, and there's basically a 1 in 6 chance that they're in any given room when I roll. Or you could say that there's a 1 in 4 chance. On a 1 to 5, the servant is in the room. On a 6 to 20, they're not. And then you roll a die and you determine that. Is a guard looking one way or the other? Good 50-50 roll. Like, are they looking one way? Are they looking another way? Maybe you say like the lower they roll, the less their attention is anywhere near you. The higher they roll, the more it's focused around the area that you're paying attention to. A 20, they're like staring right at you. So the type and severity of the weather. Now, there are weather tables that you can have, but you don't need a weather table. You can just kind of decide, okay, mild to severe, how bad is the weather, right? And you roll a 10, and you go, it's cloudy, and there's some rain that's coming in and out. A 20 would be like hail the size of golf balls is landing on your head. And one might be, no, it's a really pleasant day. So you don't even necessarily need to have tables to roll against. You can just roll the die and sort of pick things off of them while determining the time of day. Oh, a lot of time you lose track. We've been in a dungeon all this time. When we come out, what hour is it? And you roll a die, you can roll a D20, and you go, it's about 7 a.m., right? So you say it's mid-morning. Like, you know, you can kind of decide, is it mid-morning? Is it evening? Is it middle of the day? Is it first thing in the morning? You know, when is it? So time of day, really easy one. Again, roll a D20. I know there's 24 hours a day. Don't worry. Don't sweat it so much. Just roll, and that's how late or early in the day it is. Decide if an object vital to the quest is here or has been moved. What are the odds that somebody would move it? And this could add a complication where they go into the final chamber to go get the idol that they need, but somebody got there first. What are the odds that someone got there first? You could say there's a, you know, basically a 1 in 5 chance. So on a 1 to 4, the object was taken. You roll the die. I rolled a 15. It is still there. So again, you're tying these dies. You're tying these dice outcomes to different sort of elements to the game that could be randomly determined at different points of time. What path is the guard going to take to a dungeon? You can say like at any given fork, he's going to go this way or the other. You can sort of figure out the path that a guard is going to follow as they're going through a dungeon. Maybe it's like always common, but maybe not. So that's what you can determine. So the Oracle die is a really good opportunity to determine random events in your game. And where it really helps GMs is it means you don't know what's going to happen. You're being fair with the world. You're assigning the probability. You're rolling the die, but you're being fair with the world because you're not determining things based on what you want or what you feel. Instead, you're letting the dice kind of determine this. Now, one thing is you don't want to generally use the Oracle die when the characters are involved in a situation. At that point, you probably want to switch to something like an ability check. So if it isn't, you know, how grumpy a guard might be is a good reason to roll an Oracle die. How well the characters convince the guard of something is an ability check. At that point, you assign a DC. You might assign the DC based on that grumpiness check. Right, so you could actually say, for example, the DC is going to be rolled on a D20. The higher, the grumpier they are. You roll and you say, it's a 17. You need to beat a 17 in order to convince this guard. So you could do something like that if you want. You could also just stick with your 10, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 sort of scale and determine it. But basically, anytime something in the world is randomly determined outside of the abilities of the characters to interact with, that's a good time to use an Oracle die. Anytime the characters are directly involved, you probably want to use some kind of check. In the very first example I gave, where I said that the Reaver was holding a bastard sword to the throat of one of the characters, and one of the other characters was going to charge them, I could have said, roll a dexterity check. We'll say it's a 50-50 shot, DC 10, or we'll pick a static number based on the dexterity of the guy that you're going after, which would probably have been like 10 or 11. You have to beat that in order to go. That probably would have been more accurate. But on the other hand, having flat rolls can still work in that circumstance. So generally speaking, when the characters are involved, you probably want to use an ability check of some sort. You want to pick a difficulty class, pick a number for the DC, and then let the character roll an ability check with the right ability for it. But otherwise, if there's something random going on in the world itself that isn't based on the characters, that's a really good time to use an Oracle die. So an Oracle die is a fantastic tool to just help you let the game go in really interesting directions. You still get to determine what the various outcomes means, but it means that you aren't in direct control of the story. Instead, it's you determining the story based on a die roll that you roll. If you want to learn a lot more about the Oracle die, I would definitely recommend taking a look at the RPG Ironsworn. Ironsworn was the first place where I saw the Oracle die being used in lots of different places. The Oracle die in Ironsworn is used when you're running as a solo RPG a lot. All the rules for Ironsworn are online for free. I will link to them in the show notes and you can check them out. And at your next game, try out the Oracle die. I think you'll really like it. Every month on the Sly Flourish Patreon, we have a monthly Q&A. Any patron can put a question related to tabletop role-playing games. I answer every question every Friday morning. Some of the questions make it here to the show. Other ones become catalysts for articles or newsletters or videos that I do in the future. Jason K. says, I'm going to try out the 1 year later, OYL for short, montage idea at the end of my current campaign. This got my wondering about the specifics of how I might implement it. I know that I need to tell my players to focus on wrapping up plot arcs they'd like to see resolved or moved forward, and to keep the results within the realm of what their characters are actually capable of doing. I can't decide whether to let them tell their stories at the table, post their stories to our list, or send me them privately and let me present the final montage for them. I will definitely encourage them to talk things out with any player if they seek to involve that player character in their 1 year later story. I'm wondering if there's anything I haven't considered. So my question is simple. What rules, guidance, or instructions do you give your players regarding 1 year later character wrap-ups to get the results you were looking for? I'm going to be a little harsh and probably harsher than the actual situation, but you don't want to have much control over the 1 year later thing. One of the really great things about the 1 year later montage is your job is done. Your job as the GM is complete. You've built the story up to that point, and now you are handing the 1 year later montage completely over to the players to let them describe where their characters are 1 year later. You can throw out some ideas while it's going on. You can offer up connections between characters if it makes sense. Only if you think it actually makes the story even more fun for the person who's saying it. For a quick summary, a 1 year later montage is essentially at the end of a campaign, when you've completed the whole adventure, when everything is done, you ask the players to describe where their character is 1 year later. You jump forward in time and you say, those events all took place. 1 year later, where are you? Where is your character? What have you done? Where are you going? What are you doing? The campaign is over. So nothing that they decide during their 1 year later montage is going to be a problem because you're done. They can go anywhere, right? I've had players die. I've had players go off to other worlds. I've had good players turn evil. I've had all kinds of stuff happen in 1 year later montages, and they're all really interesting. I can't think of any time I haven't been just truly impressed with the kind of stuff that people have come up with for the 1 year later montage. But the main thing is you don't have a hand in it. It's your job is complete. So I think you can warn players that you're going to ask the question. And I beyond that, I don't think you have to do anything at all. I think the other job you could do is write them down and then send them out to the players after they've come up with them at the session. So I think it's really fun to do it at a session. It's almost like a session infinity, right? So you have a session zero before you run the game and the session infinity, which is the one after all the sessions. Just let them do it, right? Don't get in the way of them. Don't come up with rules. Don't say that they have to stay within the realm of their character. Don't say that they can't break certain parts of the game. Let them do whatever they want because this is their chance. And trust me, the nice thing about this is they're going to get exactly what they want because they're the one who decided. My character went on that quest for the fabled Vorpal sword. He never got. And now he has it. Great. You got it, right? You completed it. There are so many different things that they can do. So I would really pull back on any drive to sort of guide the 1 year later. You can improv with them too. You could say like, ooh, what if they did X and see how, and if they go, nah, then you go, okay, they didn't do X, right? So you can improv them with a little bit, but your job is done. And this is the chance to hand the story over to the players and let them decide what happened to their characters. So that's the main thing I wanted to come, that my main thing I wanted to come across with answering this question. Tiago L. says, I strongly admire your dedication to the City of Arches. Yay! I remember I became a patron sub right before you had released the first doc. Yeah, that was like 2 years ago. Seeing it evolve all this time has been pretty cool. How do you stay motivated through one singular theme world and not deviate or start something else? What can aspiring world builders learn from your process? May you enjoy a basket full of cheese, bread, and soaps, and with an invitation to the City Arches' famous sauna. That's a good question. It has not been hard for me to stay with the City of Arches. I really love it, and it's a very fun mental exercise for me to kind of explore another nook and cranny. I did so last weekend. Like, I've been working on it for 2 years. We're getting close to the book is already in editing. Like, we've already gone through the book and it's going into editing. And then I was like, ooh, there's one thing I really want to add that I think would be really useful for GMs and would be really fun. And that was the locations where you might run into the main quest NPCs. Like, if you're going to go talk to Rosalind Zesh, the spymaster of the queen, where does she hang out? And I was like, probably a nice little secluded coffee shop where everybody knows who she is. So I wrote up a little thing for that. We're going to add that into the book. I've really enjoyed finding little nooks and crannies all throughout the city that I get to explore, that I get to add to. I did my Dungeon 23 based on a huge mega dungeon inside the City of Arches last year. I loved, and I've been doing it for 2 years. So nothing has pulled me away from it. I've never felt the drive of like, I am bored with the City of Arches and now I want to go somewhere else. In fact, I'm a little worried that I'm still coming up with ideas for it, even though I eventually have to come out with a book. And so, but I think that'll be okay because I'll just make supplements. So patrons of Sly Flourish will continue to get supplements of the City of Arches while there is a main core City of Arches book that everybody gets. So I think that that will work. One thing I think helped me with the City of Arches in particular is that it is a sort of kitchen sink campaign that I can kind of put anything in there. I put in an underground dinosaur world in there one day. And the nice thing is, like, I can put an underground dinosaur world in there and it can be one paragraph of text. It doesn't have to be a lot of work. I don't have to like spend 6 months coming up with it. I can just say, oh yeah, if you go deep enough in the lower reaches, you go into weird chambers and catacombs that are far outside of anything anybody's explored. And rumors are there are great big dinosaurs living. There's like a big swamp and there are dinosaurs living there. I could just add it. And that's because the City of Arches is built as a place that expands in many different directions, right? It is both a focused location that you can drop into your own world, your own TTRPG, whether it's published or not, whatever campaign world you're playing in, it's just one city. And you just drop that city in the middle of your campaign. Or even one little region. If you go into the Outlands areas that are outside the city, you could take that region and drop that into an area. But all of those are expandable infinitely. So like every dungeon you go to could have more layers beneath it. The catacombs that exist above the city are an infinite range of catacombs that go back further in the mountain. The depths below can be as many levels as you want. The portals can take you to any known world. So it is always expandable in every direction. And making it expandable like that means that for me, I always get to discover new places while I'm thinking about the city or what's going on there or where things are going. So I've never been bored. Even now, typically when I reach the stage I'm reached right now with a book that I write, it's about the time I'm tired of it. And actually, I'll give you an example of this. I remember when people have been talking about Baldur's Gate 3, and it came out that Larian is not going to do a Baldur's Gate 3. And the CEO of Larian, who is the primary owner of the company, told the employees there, hey, we're not going to do another Baldur's Gate 3. He said they felt relief and elation. And everyone else of us who love Baldur's Gate 3, we're like, why? This game is so awesome. Why would you feel that? And the answer is they've been there for 5 years. They've been living in Baldur's Gate 3 for 5 years. We've only been living there for a few months, right? We've not even a year yet. And unless you've been playing like the pre-release, but even then, like you've been discovering more. So for them, they're tired of it. And when I work on a project, it's a little like that. I will be writing a book. Ruins of the Grendelroot was this way, that I had these like different ways that I felt about it. I loved it up front. I loved writing the adventures. I loved building the setting. I really loved expanding the world of the Grendelroot in the same way that the City of Arches expands that. Wow, you know, it's these 10 adventures, but it's also a whole region of this underneath this big mountain that can be expanded in all these ways. And here's a 20th level campaign seed. And here's all these random encounters. And that way, like, Ruins of the Grendelroot is not only 10 adventures, but also a campaign source book you can run. I love that idea so much. But then when I got into editing, the second round of edits, third round of edits, adding the art, struggles getting everything put together, running the Kickstarter, doing all that, I was like, I'm so tired of Ruins of the Grendelroot. Like, I can't read another word of it, right? Like, I've read it so many times now. I'm so bored with it. I can't read it again, right? And I got to that stage. And that was the stage where everyone loved it. Everyone else is like, oh, this is great. I love this world. It's interesting. It's fun. I'm getting lots of comments from people. And I'm like, wow, I hate it. And they're like, we love it. I don't know that I've reached that with City of Arches. I haven't reached it yet because I'm still loving it. But we're pretty deep into production. I got lots of art for it done. We've got the first round of editing done. Second round of editing, I got to read through it again. And maybe at that point, I'll be pretty tired of it. But like, I feel really great about it. I love the City of Arches. So there was an article on Kotke that I really liked called The Helsinki Bus Station and the Theory of Creativity. And it's a thought about switching and the cost of switching. And what he brings up is this idea that people start along a creative endeavor and then they find out someone else is doing that thing. And they say, oh man, it looks like somebody else is already doing that thing. I guess I'll switch. But they're not really switching. They're starting over again. So all of the expertise that they had in whatever path that they were following is gone now because now they're on a new path. And then they go for that for a little ways. They find out somebody else is also doing that. So they stop doing that. They reset. They go back to the station. And the reality is when you're early on a project, somebody almost certainly has done something like it. But the further along you go, the more unique your one path becomes. And instead of switching, just keep going. If you've got something that you love that you really want to dive into, just keep going. And I feel like I've done that with City of Arches. It's been hard for me to explain exactly why I love the City of Arches as much as I do and why I think this is a good campaign setting for GMs. But I kept with it anyway. And for 2 years, I've kept up with it. Now, one thing that has been a tremendous value is getting feedback from patrons all along the way. So, Diego, you mentioned that you've got it since the initial document, right? Which was like not even 12 pages, I don't think. It was pretty short. Getting feedback when it was only a few pages and then a few pages more and then a few pages more, that has been really vital in helping me make sure that the stuff that I'm developing is actually useful for people, getting the kind of feedback on what I like and what I don't, getting all that sort of stuff in order to make this book even better. That worked for the Lazy DM's Companion when I did that, and it's worked for, definitely has worked well for City of Arches. So that has been really fun. Custom Alex says, have you or your players ever got emotional or cried during a session? My perception and hopes might be unrealistic. Because of shows like Critical Role and Dimension 20, and while I don't expect that level of emotional commitment to characters, I feel my current game as a player is closer to playing Monopoly than anything more serious, leaving me unsatisfied in playing. Thanks, I'm sure it's not that big a deal and I need to get over it. I mean, you feel how you feel. Have I? Yes. I've had emotions come up during games that were good, and I've had emotions come up during games that were bad. The bad ones were caused because of unclear expectations for the other players and for a lack of clear guidance on lines and veils and for having any kind of sort of X card like thing. I learned a lot from that experience, and now I am a big proponent of having session zeros and making sure that we have clear lines and veils for things, making sure that we have pause for a minute, which is my verbal X card, pause for a minute. Let's make sure as players we're okay with what's going on. And keeping an eye towards that sensitivity to make sure that it does not get to the point where a player gets upset about something that has happened in the game that is not I've also had players get emotional in a good way, where they are really tied up in the story and they've seen things happen and they feel the way their character feels about it. And that gets emotional. I've only had that happen like once or twice, but it's pretty good when that's going on, right? It's pretty, when you can get that level of emotion, that's great. I don't know that you can make people get there. Now you can, there's some ways to help your players get into their characters more, like by addressing the characters, asking them how they feel about things, using things like campfire tales to ask them how they feel about the events in the past and events in the future, kind of asking those, how does so-and-so feel about this? Like, as you watch this happen, how does that feel to you? And it helps them recognize that they can get into their character and hopefully be a little vulnerable. But some people are just not into that. They don't want to go, they're not going to have a good cry. They're not going to D&D to have a good cry. And for them, playing Monopoly is playing Monopoly, and that's what they want to do. So I'm a lot less concerned about trying to make that emotional connection with people. And when they happen, I try not to like make them bad, try to avoid the jokes. If somebody starts to joke, kind of stop them and let the event play out. But I don't think we need to get there. And I don't know that there's much you can do to make it go there. I would be careful. I'd be very careful about trying to make something like that happen, because then you could go from the good cry to the bad cry pretty easily. If you succeed, you could do it for the wrong reason and with the wrong feeling. So I would definitely just run the game. Don't hold yourself to the standards of online shows, of very heavily produced shows. And but there are things that you could do to kind of help your players get into the minds of their characters. Campfire stories, doing like the equivalent of Stars and Wishes, but from a character perspective. What does your character hope to accomplish during their adventures? What are the things that they're most proud of? How do they feel about, what event really caught their eye from the other characters? I think that can really help your players build emotional connections to their characters. But you're only going to get so far. So I honestly, this is another one. Don't beat yourself up. Just run your game and enjoy your game and have fun with your friends. Don't try to hold yourself to standards above and beyond having a good time with your friends. Friends, I want to thank all of you for hanging out with me today while we talked about all things in tabletop role-playing games. If you enjoyed this show, please consider subscribing to the Sly Flourish newsletter. It is the best way to see all of the material that I put out every week. You get a weekly RPG-related email with links to all of the other stuff that I do and the set of tips that I offer every week. You can also support me directly on Patreon. Patrons get access to things like the Forge of Foes tools, but a whole bunch of other tools, a whole bunch of different exclusive adventures, awesome community over on our dedicated Discord server, and it helps me put on these shows. It helps support me directly, so please consider that. And you can pick up my books like Forge of Foes, Lazy DM's Companion, Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, Lazy DM's Workbook, and all of the fantastic books, including Ruins of the Grendel Root, on the Sly Flourish bookstore. Please check those out. Thank you so much. Have a great day, and get out there and play an RPG.